Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I'm your host, Bill Brewster. As always, thank you for tuning in. This episode features Adam Wyden. Adam stops by and talks about his philosophy, shares some lessons learned. It's a good conversation covering a number of topics, but I particularly enjoyed talking to him and the way he thinks about analyzing the mistakes that he's made, replaying the playbook, getting better all the time, focusing on what management teams are doing to build out the bench in order to make sure that the business is ready for the next 3 to 5 years of growth. And there's a number of things that I would take from it. And I just think it's an overall good conversation. You know, maybe it shows a side of Adam that people haven't seen before. So I hope you all enjoy the episode. I enjoyed recording it, and I've enjoyed getting to know Adam over the past few months. This episode is featured by Stratosphere.io, Stratosphere.io. Rather than do the normal read, I'm just going to tell you, I was using it today, clicked on some filings. It brought me to Shad Rowe of Greenbrier Partners portfolio. I was going through different time periods of his 13F. Clicked on Apple very intuitively, took me to some segments and KPIs, and then clicked on the industry. Right now I'm looking at, you know, operating profit margin, returns on equity versus all the comps in the industry, and just a very seamless experience. So, you know, I think what Braden and his team are building over there is worth checking out. And should you want to sign up for the paid product, please use the promo code BREW for 15% off. But head on over to stratosphere.io for a free trial. Again, that's Stratosphere.io. And give it a look-see. I think you'll enjoy what you find. All right. You know the drill, as always. None of this is financial advice. All of the information contained in this program is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult your financial advisor before making investment decisions and do your own due diligence. Enjoy the show. I am here because it's like hedge fund week in Miami. There's a bunch of all guys. So my buddy Jason Buck wanted me to come down. Well, invited me to dinner. And like, I was talking to some people about option pricing and vol structure and stuff. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about with these people, but I'm happy to be down here.
It's hedge fund week. Yeah, no, it's I'm not participating in hedge fund week. We went to Context and iConnections for several years, and you know, it was always a nice reason to come down to Miami Beach, stay at the Fountain Blue, and meet a bunch of people and put a suit on. But you know what I found is that when you live in Miami Beach 24/7, the last thing you want to do is go to a hedge fund convention. And anyone that wants to see you when they're down for the hedge fund convention comes and finds you. So yeah. I've got a bunch of dinners planned this week, and it's sort of nice. You know, it's sort of like, oh, that's how the other half lives. You know, you live in New York, you come down for a couple of days. I'm like, oh, I get to live here around the clock. It's pretty nice.
Yeah, it is nice. You know, it was kind of interesting. Like, I was one of the guys that I was talking to. They basically, it seems to me, try to take advantage of like market structure and specifically like term structure. Like, they have a theory that the front end of the options curve is basically like artificially, well, not artificially depressed, but too cheap. No, wait, too expensive because of, front end has too much selling because it's like retail and like stupid wealth managers trying to create yield. So they can buy that. And then I think they said they sell the longer dated stuff because insurance companies have to buy it. I don't know. They'll come on the pod and explain. But
oh, interesting.
I figured, you know, I don't know. I was like, oh, I could see how a scenario where you can like do like value investing and options, right? Because basically that whole conversation was about exploiting the inefficiencies in the market that exist because of incentives.
Yeah. Oh, they're for sure. I mean, that goes without saying. I mean, look, options are a great strategy. I mean, look, if you know, if properly used, if you're Mark Cuban and you get a bunch of Yahoo stock and you want to find a way to, and you're restricted in it and you want to basically, you know, create a collar and basically lock in your economics, that's an exceedingly good way to basically, you know, for whatever reason, you've got a large tax bill, you know, you own a bunch of things, you have a large tax bill, you want to collar it, you want to, sorting against the box can be challenging because you have to take it off. But, you know, if you want to collar a position, if you, you know, that you're restricted in or collar position because, you know, you don't want to necessarily sell it that year because maybe you think that this will be a year where the stock might go down or may trade sideways, but you want to be hedged from market, but you want to own it long term. I mean, look, there's a variety of different. I mean, another thing is, let's say you want to limit the capital that you have. I mean, think about it for a minute, right? If the actual investment itself is an option, right, where there is some binary range of outcomes, right? Let's say, you know, there's a 50% chance it's a 10X and there's a 50% chance like everything goes to hell in a handbasket. You say, well, I want to put a 1% of my capital. Well, maybe that the right answer is 1% of your capital in calls because you say, look, I'm going to lose the 1% if it doesn't work. So why not magnify the upside in the context that it does work, right? You're sort of risking the same amount of capital. Now, obviously, there's plenty of issues as it relates to timing, sort of how you execute on that. But like, you know, I think, you know, options provide, you know, a really nice way to sort of define your risk. I mean, use Carvana as an example. Lots of people were short Carvana. You know, you had a, well, you know, a mutual friend on your podcast who expressed, you know, a short position in Carvana through puts. Now, you know, there were plenty of people that were short Carvana. And if you wanted to, you know, put a 5 or 10% position on in Carvana and it went up 20X in your face, it's like a GameStop scenario. Now, let's say you were short Carvana at $200. And let's say you said, you know, I think it's going to go to zero. And you put 2% in leap puts and you buy them out 2 years and you're like, oh, well, you know, if the thing goes from 200 to 400, you're probably not even losing all of your principal because you still have the time value and you've sort of limited your downside. Now, if the thing went from 200 to five and you add 2% of your capital, chances are you're still going to be making multiples of your money. So that would be a scenario where you'd want to express, you know, sort of a short position, which, you know, with sort of, you know, limited downside. So I actually think where puts and more importantly, just, you know, broadly speaking, you know, sort of these portfolio insurance things, whether it's a swaption, you know, we heard stories about Michael Dell basically buying interest rate swaps on, you know, something. There was a reason why he did it, but like he bought a bunch of it because he wanted to sort of, you know, hedge his interest rate thing. And then he was like, he was looking at the skew in the trade. And I think he put, I don't know, some insane, like small amount of money, 15, 20 for relative to net worth, but he put like $15, $20, $30 million into these swaps. And I think he made billions of dollars on it. And it's sort of like, you know, you think about sort of these portfolio insurance things. I mean, it's incredible how people sort of never price the risk of the, you know, the sigma event, right? Whether it be, you know, the 10-year going from, you know, whatever it was, you know, 2% to 4 or what, or whatever, 1% or whatever it was to 4 or 5, or and the 10-year isn't there, but like, let's say the 2-year rate at that, you know, let's say the 2-year rate, you know, was, I don't know, 1% or whatever, and now it's 4.25% or whatever it is, like, you know, to have interest rates move that much that quickly, like it's, people couldn't really price that risk the same way people couldn't, you know, price in, you know, the risk of sort of the mortgage market imploding or, you know, or whatever happened with high yield. I mean, look what Ackman did during COVID, right? He recognized that, you know, companies could get really, really stressed. And he said, well, what would it cost me to buy portfolio insurance? So, you know, I think, you know, this whole concept of sort of portfolio insurance, I think is interesting that it always sort of misprices sort of the sigma events. And it's sort of like, why would anyone ever short a single name stock where you have, you know, finite, you know, I sort of think about it, I'm like, does it ever really make sense to like short a single name stock? Now, obviously, if there are no options on it or whatever, but like I sort of come back to the point, which is that like you could have shorted GameStop all the way down and, you know, and made 25% and, you know, even had a 50 basis point GameStop position at the top and lost your entire fund. Something like, you know what I'm saying? So it's just, it's interesting how people think about sort of the asymmetries. And it's like, I think about shorting stocks, I'm like, it's just so asymmetric. Now, obviously you're shorting indexes, whatever, but I'm saying shorting a single name stock and, you know, it's like, it's very, very hard in terms of the asymmetry. Now, conversely, when you think about put options or credit default swaps or like, you know, interest rate swaps or, you know, any of these are, you know, sort of bespoke securities that are supported, you know, supposed to sort of provide, you know, levered protection. It's interesting the amount of protection they give relative to the amount of capital that is, you know, effectively at risk, right? If you bought 1% puts or 2% puts on Carvana, I'm just doing the math. I'm again, it's out of the money, whatever. Got to get the timing right. It's like, oh, well, it's 400 and got to go to zero over the next 2 years. But I mean, if you bought, you know, again, I don't know the exact numbers, but if you were short Carvana at 200 and you bought $100 puts on it out 2 years and it went to 400, I'm pretty sure you made a lot of money, like many multiples of your money, you know? So, you know, look, you had your guest on here. He made, you know, whatever, made 400% last year or something crazy. So, you know, it's just interesting how people price risk and, you know, the different securities that allow you to do it. I mean, obviously the best way to do it is to have a big position in something that goes up 100X. But, you know that's the best thing, right? You hit a monster beverage and, you know, zygazoon, you're good. But while we're waiting to find the next monster beverage, I do think that, you know, sort of, you know, finding these sort of interesting asymmetries, you know, as expressed by, you know, sort of options and this and that. I think it's just an interesting sort of thing that interesting to us that the sort of the market always seems to price it wrong.
Yeah. I guess when I talk to the options guys, the things that my big takeaway is if I were to play in options for long enough, they would over the long term skin me. So I tend to avoid them, but I don't disagree. If you've got some sort of long-term view, like, you know, I mean, Greenblatt wrote about it in You Can Be a Stock Market Genius, right? Using leaps to amplify your returns.
I had lunch with Joel Greenblatt last week, and it was just like it was like going to see the Pope. It was literally, I can't, like, you'd probably be embarrassed if you heard this, but it was like the best, one of the best experiences of my life. I was like literally going there and I had lunch with him. I was like, this is like seeing the Pope. This is the guy who wrote the book. This is the guy who did it. And it was just like, oh my goodness. Like, he's a living, breathing thing. I thought he was just some guy in a book. But yeah, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, look, you know, it's not rocket science. I mean, it requires sort of, you know, having the emotional fortitude and wherewithal and, you know, all of the things that are, you know, sort of required to execute on this. But yeah, I mean, look, yeah, Wells Fargo, that's a great example. He said, look, you know, we were coming out of, I remember he was telling me about it. He's like, you know, well, you know, we were coming out of the SNL crisis and, you know, Wells Fargo was a super well-capitalized bank. And I said, if any bank's going to survive, it's going to be this one. And I forget, he didn't remember exactly what it was, but I think he bought like 5, 6, 7. I mean, I don't remember the exact number, but he bought like some number and he bought it out many years. I think it was 5, 6, 7% and of his capital. And it was, there were leaps. So I think they were out a few years. And he was like, look, you know, if the world goes to hell in a handbasket, I lose 1.5% a year. And I think he made a comment that they made like 8 or 9 or 10 times their money on it. Eddie Lampert did the same thing. I think Eddie Lampert, both him and Eddie both had, I mean, I know a couple guys that did it, you know, coming out of 08, 09, like a lot of guys, you know, and it's interesting because you think about the banks were trading at such low multiples of book value in 08, 09, and you didn't really know what the book value was and how much more was going to get written down. But it was a very simple thesis, right? It was like, oh, well, these things are trading at 0.25 times 0.3 times book. But what people didn't realize is that if the economy actually rebounded, there was a natural reflation in the book value. Remember, if the world comes back, then, you know, all the defaulted mortgages, all the things that had to, quote unquote, be written down, like, they heal. There's like a natural, there's a reflexivity to it. There's some healing mechanism. So it's like, well, you could buy S&P calls, or you're like, oh, I could buy, you know, banks. And I'm like, yeah, the banks aren't going to trade at 2x book value again for a while because they're going to be impaired and they're going to be in handcuffs because of Basel II and III and all the different things that made them do crazy things. But, you know, you didn't have to engineer too much to figure out that, like, oh, like, these things could triple. Right. You know, like, you know, if they were 0.25 or 0.3 times book, you know, you could sort of get to 0.9 times book and, you know, maybe they make a little bit of money and you could sort of get it. And so a lot of guys, Tepper, I think, did it. A few other guys did it where I'll tell you what a lot of these guys did is they bought these preferreds. A lot of these guys were buying the bank preferreds under the similar thesis, right? You're getting a coupon. These things were trading at, you know, whatever, 30, 40, 50 cents on the dollar. And even if the equity got wiped, you know, if they survive. But yeah, I mean, look, it's all about sort of understanding those things. Wells Fargo, I think they had IBM leaps, or Eddie. I don't know if Eddie and Joel both did IBM leaps. I know Eddie did IBM leaps. But, you know, it's an interesting thing because it's sort of like, you know, if you're buying something that's exceedingly cheap from a micro perspective, you don't really necessarily need options to like leverage the return. But like, if you're sort of saying, hey, I don't know when this is going to work. I don't want to have an enormous amount of capital tied up in it. But like, if sort of the macro hits right, you know, you can sort of, I think leaps are interesting for sort of macro plays where it's sort of like Wells Fargo is sort of like, you know, buying Wells Fargo out of SNL or like buying Bank of America, like in the middle of 08, 09. It's sort of like, okay, like, you know, it's cheap. I'm not like smart enough to go through all of Bank of America's balance sheet and understand it. It's like, I know that if things sort of reflate and the economy comes back, these things won't trade at, you know, 0.25 or 0.3 or whatever times book. And you'll make a little bit of money and you'll buy it out a few years and you sort of get a levered return that way without risking a lot of capital or tying up a lot of capital.
Yeah. And easy to say in retrospect, but if Wells Fargo's book is only worth 0.1 times, we might have some problems in the economy that it doesn't even matter anymore. Like there might be a lot of zeros out there and then you're talking about depression, right? Whereas you just say, okay, well, if we resume normal, I should get some juice on the backside and leaps can add it. What do you ask the Pope when you meet him?
Do you ask the Pope when you meet him?
Do you ask him to bless you with the value investing
No,
Holy water?
I mean, I didn't ask for anything. I just wanted to.
No, I mean, like, just to get the conversation started. I can't imagine, like, that would be really cool to talk to him.
Yeah, he's just
in like a real setting.
He's just got an enormous amount of humility. He's just a super menschy guy. Like, I think he truly loves what he does. I think very interested in giving back to the community. And, you know, he's got his charter schools. You know, he's been a teacher, an adjunct teacher at Columbia Business School. I mean, I think he's just a lovely guy. I don't think you could meet a nicer individual, which is sort of like, you know, you sort of naturally think, well, anyone that's good in the stock business is sort of a jerk and they, you know, eat people alive and this and that. And it's like, you look at this guy and like very disciplined, honest, hardworking, sort of self-effacing, lots of humility. I mean, we just talked about, you know, I talked a lot about, you know, sort of what my aspirations were for the business, you know, how I sort of evolved from, you know, doing a ton of sort of more eventy things with sort of a finite life, you know, spinoffs and stuff like that, and sort of getting into it and then saying, you know, can we find a, you know, use these events and these sort of special situations to start a good entry point for a compounder, and sort of how we built upon our thing, which is, can we find these things, whether it's API group or PAR or Rick or whatever, can you find these things, you know, some of the parts, deal within a deal, you know, sort of an event, sort of special situations bend, but sort of allow that to sort of manifest itself into a compounder, which means that you've got to sort of buy high quality businesses that are misunderstood in an event. And sort of instead of just buying some crappy little business that was sort of, you know, it was spun off and it traded at 4x earnings and traded 8x earnings and, you know, I'm in and I'm out. And it was just interesting to sort of talk about that and sort of, you know, my evolution as an investor and, you know, sort of how he, you know, what their evolution as an investor was and, you know, all those things. I mean, again, it's sort of like you're trying to build upon your process. You're not trying to do, you know, sort of 180s, but like, you know, sort of learning from what works and what is the, you know, right, what is the right thing for sort of, you know, sort of your mentality and your investor base and sort of your personality. And, you know, what I'd find is that, like, you know, I don't ever want to be caught in a situation where, like, I own a business that's sort of suboptimal and I sort of miss it. And I've sort of like, well, you bought it here and you got to sell it here. It's sort of like, I want to be in a situation where if I underwrite the business right and the macro changes against me, I can sort of buy it on dips. And so, you know, for me, it's sort of like, you know, whether it was our experience with fiat or whatever, it's like, we don't want to be in a situation where, you know, it's like, oh, we own a lower quality business that, like, you know, people are never going to see as a high quality business. And we're sort of, you know, chasing our tails on cyclicality. And so.
So what was your experience with fiat?
You know, we bought it really well. You know, we bought it to own Ferrari initially. Then, you know, Ferrari got spun off. We bought a bunch of Ferrari because it got super cheap and we liked it. And then the answer was, is as we, you know, sort of, you know, we, you know, naturally as a spinoff investor, you'd say, well, should we sell Fiat and just focus on Ferrari? And the answer was, is we sort of did the study and we're like, well, it's still really cheap on a sum of the parts basis. You know, it was trading at whatever it was, I don't know, 1 or 2x earnings. And they had Magneti Marelli, they had the, you know, which was their parts business. They still had Maserati and Alfa. And, you know, there's other things in there that were sort of higher quality. And we sort of looked at it and we said, well, you know, Sergio had done this sort of Confessions of a Capital Junkie PowerPoint presentation, basically saying, well, this could be like the defense contractors and return on invested capital is X. And if they all merge, return on invested capital is Y. But, you know, again, you sort of were, you know, I don't know, 10 years or 20 years early. Basically, the idea was, is that the auto industry needed to consolidate. The return on invested capital could be good, but how many years did it take for the railroads to get there? And, you know, at what point does this, you know, do these things get so large that, like, the replacement cost is the value and they're not all, you know, spending the same money on R&D? And, you know, there was just a lot of wasted economic capital that, you know, basically facilitated itself in, you know, sort of bad ROICs and ROEs. And so from our perspective, you know, I think, you know, we sort of overvalued sort of the blue sky. And I think in our minds, and look, you know, I always joke around with people, like, it's entirely possible that the mass market auto industry generates really good returns on invested capital. It might just be with three players in the United States or one player or whatever it is. And, you know, it may be a scenario where, you know, we go fully autonomous. I mean, Greg Alexander from Acacia, who's just an amazing guy, has this whole thesis that, you know, these auto companies are eventually going to develop these subscription businesses. And, you know, that business is going to basically quantify the entire market cap, right? If you're Fiat or GM and, you know, you have, you know, a SaaS element where, like, you manage the maintenance and, you know, maybe some component of the autonomous and you're paying $100 a year or something like, or $100 a month, and it's $1,200 a year. And, you know, that, you know, that's a SaaS business that, you know, has low churn and this and that, you know, maybe that, you know, that sort of substantiates the entire market cap. So, you know, again, I think things are the way they are until they aren't. And I think trying to call these turns is incredibly hard. And it's entirely possible that, like, you know, all the duplicative R&D and all the rest, you know, that everyone is spending on electrification, this and that, these companies could merge and, you know, the ROICs could get better and there's more pricing rationality and blah, 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 blah. And like, but, you know, that could be 10 years, it could be 30 years. And I think what we sort of, you know, we're looking at was what this business could look like in the future and not what it looks like today. And I think the key is finding these businesses where it looks like one thing today, but it becomes something else very quickly. And, you know, trying to find these businesses with their inflection points.
So are you focused on, I mean, I know M&A comes up when we chat and generally in the businesses that you're looking at, I think either M&A or organic opportunities. Like Rick, you've got the rollout of a franchise concept. API Group, I think, is more M&A. Is that fair?
I mean, I think ultimately, you know, you want organic in every business. It's just the quantity of how much, right? And so, like, you know, everybody wants a monster beverage where you have a brand and you call all the grocery stores and you grow 50% or 100% a year with no, or like a MasterCard or a Ferrari. I mean, look at Ferrari, right? Like, they were growing volumes at like 2% a year, and global high net worth individuals were compounding at, you know, I don't know, 10 to 15% a year, right? And their net worth was compounding at 10% a year. So imagine a scenario where you've basically been compounding volumes at 2% a year and sort of like the TAM, so to speak, has been compounding at 25, right? The number of people have been compounding at 10 to 15% and they've also been compounding their net worth at that. So you think about sort of that schematic, which is why, to me, that's why all this crazy stuff that's been going on with watches and cars is happening, because there's so many rich people and not enough product. They've massively underserved the market. And so from our perspective, it was like, okay, if Ferrari had a, you know, whatever, 12, 15% EBIT margin, and the margins were obfuscated by, you know, the Maserati engine business and the Formula One business, and we figured out that, like, the incremental margin on a $300,000 or $400,000 car was 75%. And we said, okay, if they actually sell more cars, you know, line as X approaches infinity, the margins are going to go from 15 to 50. And they basically did. The reason why we sold it was because they sort of increased production a little bit, which is more than 2%. But, like, you know, they didn't really, you know, look at it as a growth asset. Like, they were sort of comfortable saying, okay, we're going to compound earnings at, you know, 10, 15%, you know, for the long term. And that sort of didn't meet our threshold for return. But I mean, look, in a perfect world, we want organic. Right. There are just very few assets that can produce the level of organic that can generate a 50 to 100% IRR. Right. And so, you know, MasterCard was a unique set of circumstances. I mean, God bless MasterCard. I need one of those in my life. Want a MasterCard. Give me Hanson. Give me a special situation setup. Give me a demutualization. Give me a spinoff from the banks. Give me an IPO with 12% margins and 90% incrementals. Oh, man. Good night. You're good. You're good for life. And, they're hard to find. So I think in general, like, we want good businesses that are not cyclical. We want business with pricing power. We want, you know, businesses with volume growth. But, you know, look, if Rick is a 6% comp growth and 10 to 15% earnings growth, you know, it trades at a 10% free cash flow yield. You'll make a 20 to 25 IRR, assuming no multiple expansion. Now, if you get multiple expansion, it'll be higher. And if there's M&A, they'll be higher. But I mean, again, it's sort of like, you know, are there other organic opportunities at Rick? There are. They've got the franchising of the Bombshells. They've got these casinos that they're looking at. You know, I think the Central City sort of Gentleman's Club casino, I think, will be amazing. I think, you know, I don't know what the cash on cash return will be on that, but I suspect, and I think people are very negative, but, you know, I suspect that, you know, when all is said and done, they will be building these things at 1 to 2 times EBITDA, which is, you know, better than what they're doing the gentlemen's clubs. You know, now, obviously, you got to get the license. Obviously, there's lots of things. It's hard to get a gentleman's club license on a standalone basis. But, you know, I think opportunistically, if they can grow doing M&A and organic, you know, these different things, you know, they can grow earnings, at least for the foreseeable future, you know, 30, 40%. You know, EBITDA and probably free cash flow faster. So, you know, again, it's sort of like, yeah, the Shangri-La is that you have a business that's growing organically and doing M&A and or a company that's growing organically 50 to 100%. But it just, they're hard to find. I mean, they exist. I mean, if the growth algorithm for Ferrari was more in lockstep with what we had expected it to be, right, where they would have had a four-door sedan and they would have brought the SUV out, like, there was a scenario to be had that Ferrari could have compounded earnings at 50 like MasterCard. But, you know, Sergio died. You know, Sergio was, you know, this was going to be his retirement plan. He was going to get out of Fiat and do Ferrari and, you know, make it a big thing. But, you know, again, like, you know, in any family run business, you know, preservation of capital was sort of more valuable than a compounding of capital. I still think Ferrari is a massively under monetized asset. But, you know, it's the same reason why we think Patek Philippe and some other companies. I mean, there are a number of private businesses that are doing. I mean, Chanel is an amazing company. I mean, Chanel, I mean, I look at what Chanel has done, and then I look at what Patek and Ferrari's done, and I'm like, look what Chanel has done with that brand. I mean, you know, they've created entry points for all different types of Americans, you know, low-priced cosmetics, high-priced handbags, shoes, couture. I mean, that business is one of the most well-run companies I've ever seen.
But how do you do that with something like Ferrari without diluting the brand?
Well, I mean, Chanel, did they dilute Chanel because you can go and buy lipstick at Saks?
No, and you don't have to go that far down market.
No,
right?
You don't. Well, I'll give you an example. How would Ferrari or Patek have done it, right? Well, Patek's not public, but how would a Ferrari done it? I don't think it would have been. So again, I'm a little bit dated on Ferrari, so humor me for a minute. But like when we first owned it, I think there were like seven different models. There was like the 488, there was the F series, there was the, you know, whatever, the California, they had, you know, they had the special editions. But when all was said and done, you know, you sort of had, you had the FF. I mean, he had like seven models, you know, maybe six or seven models. And, you know, the argument is there were the specialis and the special editions and the, what do you call it? They'd have the specials, and then they'd have the Iconas, which were like the super specials. But, you know, I don't think it would have bastardized the brand. And they've done a little bit of it. I mean, they brought back, you know, sort of the Dino, you know, I forget what the thing is. I think it's the Monza. The Monza is effectively the Dino, right? They've expanded the lineup a little bit, right? But like, if you think about it, you know, Patek makes, you know, I don't know, 200 different types of watches. They could have done a big SUV. They could have done a little SUV. They could have done a four-door. You know, they could have done, you know, they could have done like they, in the old days, they had like the big saloon two doors, you know, they have the 812 TDF, but like they don't, that's not really, that's a pretty hard ride. So like, you know, I think there's lots of things they could do where they wouldn't be increasing the units per SKU, but they're increasing the number of SKUs. And I refuse to believe that sort of the, you know, the way you bastardize the brand is by making too much of any one thing. But if it's, you're really in the collector's business, right? You know, and I think Patek has done a better job of this, is like sort of expanding the lineup.
Porsche's done a reasonably good job. Not as higher end, right? Or not quite at the highest end, but I feel like they've done a pretty good job with some extensions.
Yeah, I mean, Porsche is a good company. I haven't really done a ton of work on it as a public company. You know, I know they IPO'd it. I mean, Porsche, the challenge with Porsche is, you know, they've got, you know, you've got the Saxony and, you know, Lower Saxony, and you've got pension, and you've got the government, and you've got a controlling shareholder. And, you know, I think the question becomes there, it's like, who are you actually operating the company for? Where's the profit going? So, you know, I think the thing that's kind of sort of kept us away from sort of doing more work on Porsche is sort of the economic incentives and the structure and the governance. But yeah, I mean, look, I think Porsche has done a nice sort of stratification, right? You got the GT3, you got the GT3 RS, you've got the GT2. I mean, you know, I don't have the total figures on how many GT3s they're building versus how many the Ferraris are building. I know they've got, you know,
they could build more GT3s if they wanted to.
Of course they could. And, you know, they've got the Cayenne Turbo. They got the Cayenne Turbo GT. They've got, you know, GT3. They got GT3 RS. They've got, GT2 RS. But yeah, I mean, look, they've got, you know, GT3 Touring, GT3 Wing. They've got, you know, they've got that stuff. I mean, look, you know, they've got the Turbo S, you know, it's more friendly. You know, you've got the paint to sample counterculture.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, like Ferrari, you know, Ferrari, you sort of, you know, you can't, you know, all Ferraris are Italier, but like, you know, they're sort of the colors, you know, going and picking it up in Germany, the exclusive manufacturer. I think what Porsche has done really well is their Italier is much better than Ferrari. Now, that's not to say that Ferrari doesn't have a good Italier. You can get Laura Pian in there. You can do all this stuff. But I think Porsche does a really good job sort of marketing it and sort of, you know, letting people, you know, it be available to people. I mean, I also think in general, just like the Porsche is a more understated car. It's an easier car to sort of daily drive. You know, I think it's, you know, yeah. And also, I'll tell you the other thing about Porsche is they've made it upwardly mobile, right? So again, going back to it, it's like you can buy a Boxster
without diluting the brand.
Exactly.
Too.
So like you have a Boxster at like whatever, I don't know what a Boxster costs, 60, 70 grand. It's like not that much. And, you know, and it's sort of like the price of entry, but you got the Cayman, they still have the Cayman, although I think it's called something else now. I think maybe it's called like the 718, but like they've sort of got a mid-engine car. They've got, you know, whatever, the Boxster. They've got, you know, the electric, they've got the Taycan, you know, they've got the, you know, and then they've got, you know, the 911 and then the S and the 4S and the Targa and the Turbo. And so, you know, I think, you know, they've sort of created a counterculture of sort of being upwardly mobile and sort of, you know, getting, you know, an entry into the brand. And, you know, some people would argue, well, if, you know, you can get into the brand, you know, at a low price, that's no good. But yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, I think building brands is super interesting to us, and sort of understanding, you know, sort of how you acquire customers. And even like with a company like PAR, you know, when you're selling software and you're like, oh, well, I'm going to sell them this module. And then as their business grows, I'm going to sell them more modules, right? Like the best, the thing that people want, right? Whether you're Paddock or Ferrari or PAR, is you want to grow, you want to be able to grow with your customer. You want to be able to upsell them, right? So you sell a guy a Paddock and, you know, he's 30 years old and he got his first bonus, and then suddenly he's 60 years old and he's got, you know, a whole case of them because he's become in love with the brand. Same with Porsche, same with Ferrari. You know, in PAR, you know, you start selling, you know, one software module to, you know, that what we want with PAR is, you know, we want to find, you know, a Cava or a Sweetgreen or one of these companies, you know, that's 100 units and they take one product, and then suddenly you find them, you know, 10 years later and they've got 3,000 units and they got all the products, right? That's the Shangri-La, right? You find a customer that you can grow with and upsell and develop a more sort of, you know, more global or multidimensional relationship. I mean, that's what we're trying to find with our investors too, right? Like we want to find people that, you know, are sort of like, hey, we want to grow with you and be with you and have a multidimensional relationship. You know, you're not just investing in a tear sheet, you're investing in a person, and, you know, you guys both can grow with one another. But that's sort of the challenging part in business, right? It's sort of like, you know, making it personal, being sort of a day-to-day guy, like really, you know, and a lot of companies do this poorly, right? Like, and I think really good companies like Chanel, like Porsche, it's like they obviously, you know, differentiate between a Boxster and a 911 Turbo S and, you know, all the rest. But like at the end of the day, like they want you to grow with them. They want you to be able to afford to buy that big car. And I think, you know, that's important, right? To value sort of the life cycle of a customer and people and sort of being, you know, personally invested in sort of that success. Like you don't want to be like, oh, you can't afford this, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, we want to help you. We want to be with you. We want to grow with you. And I think that to me is sort of elemental to business, whether it's, you know, in raising money for a fund, or whether it's a company providing software and services, or, you know, a company that says, hey, you know, we want you to be part of our counterculture and we don't care that, you know, you can't afford X, Y, and Z Atelier, or, you know, blah, 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 blah. Like, you know, you got to start somewhere. And yeah. I think it's just, there's such a human element to everything that we do. Like just understanding, like, what are the incentives of the company, of management, of people. And I think people just don't put enough, you know, sort of effort and energy into sort of understanding, you know, how emotionally invested and sort of the, you know, the human element to all of this.
How's sort of like that philosophy, how do you cultivate the LPs that you have? Because, You're heavily invested alongside them in the fund. This is your primary method of gaining wealth for yourself, right? So how are you aligning yourself with your LPs?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, look, you know, obviously, you know, when I started this partnership, I started with very little money. You know, I actually had, you know, a personal...
How did you start?
I had been investing for a really long time. You know, my great uncle was a day one investor in Price Club and Qualcomm. And, you know, his thing was, you know, invest with, you know, guys that have more to lose than you do. And, you know, that, you know, led him to Saul Price and Irwin Jacobs. And he started Hot, you know, he was actually the day one investor in Hot Topic. He started a regional bank with, you know, that eventually got sold to Golden West Financial and then Wachovia, Herb Marion Sandler. And he was just a, you know, really wonderful, lovely guy, dyslexic Jewish guy, really, really lovely. And, you know, I'm so lucky to have known him and sort of learned a little bit. He died very young. And then I had another, you know, sort of cousin who worked for Stanley Gold at Shamrock and sort of took over this, you know, jackup drilling company called UTI Energy that had effectively merged with Patterson. And, you know, I, you know, the two of them just had such a grand old time doing what they were doing, building these businesses, meeting new people. I'm like, man, I got to do this. And, you know, I got some stock.
So what age are you when you think like, I got to do this?
I was like probably like 13 or something like that. I was young, 12, 13 years old. I was always interested in business, but you know, I sort of had businesses growing up. I obviously I'm a huge gearhead. I had a car detailing business in high school. I love cars. I built remote control cars in, middle school and sold them on eBay. I had a car detailing business. So, I was always sort of, doing things to make money and sort of building small businesses. But, I was always interested in the stock market. I worked at a big fund, summer of my junior year, and it was interesting, but it sort of was like, I think it was, sort of more of like a traditional hedge fund with trading quarters and this and that. And it wasn't a good fit for me interpersonally. So I went to go work for sort of a boutique merchant bank out of college, and a guy there.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And a guy there, lovely guy. He had lost both of his parents in a car accident, and he inherited a little bit of money, and really, really lovely guy. And he said, "Oh, you got to read these books." And I had read a little bit on Buffett, but I hadn't read Snowball yet. And, I can't remember if I'd read Margin of Safety or Intelligent Investor, but he said, "You gotta find this guy, this Jewish guy." He went to Penn. Turns out he was in my fraternity, Joel Greenblatt, the Pope. And he's like, "You gotta read these books." And I was like, "Whoa." And I just like, it blew me away. It was like there was darkness and there was lightness. It was like the guy wrote in a way that was so sort of elemental. I was like, "Oh, wait, like, you're telling me that, like, there are ways to screen for companies, like, return on invested capital, spinoffs, buy, insider buying." There were all these things. And it sort of all kind of came together at once. Because remember, Capital IQ and Bloomberg and FactSet, those things were relatively early. This is 2006. And so I was sitting there with all these sort of tools. And I was like, "Oh, wait, I can use Capital IQ to like find all these things, like all these things that are in the book." Like these guys, even when Joel wrote the book originally, the technology wasn't there. Right. So they would subscribe to news, Value Line and all these sort of newsletter things that were sort of aggregating data. And I was like, "I actually have the tools to figure it out, using the technology here." And I was like, "Wow." And it's just the light bulb went off. I was like, "Okay, it doesn't really matter. I'm not just like going and having some guy pitch me a stock, or, my grandmother or my, my great uncle or someone." Like it was very much less of a top down where it's like, "Oh, I got an iPhone. Let me look at Apple." It was more like, what are the companies out there that sort of meet these financial criterion that sort of are the, set up for 100 baggers? And, can I sort of create the technology or sort of the feeding mechanism to find these things? Now, obviously, that was contemporaneous. If you think about the timing, this was sort of contemporaneous with sort of the great financial crisis. So, I finished working, I think, the summer of 08. I started Columbia Business School in January of 09 in their J-Term program. And I remember, just like, going through these screens, and I'd set them up, at Columbia, and I set them up at my former office. And I remember being like, "Oh man, I'm using this stuff." And then you have all these dislocations, like you have all the stuff they read about in the books. And I'm like, and then you have like, Boku opportunities. And I just, while I was in Columbia Business School, I found these crazy opportunities. Like I remember Rodman and Renshaw was like trading for like 10 cents and they had a dollar of cash and they were run rating a dollar. And then we're buying it from 10 cents to 30 cents and sold it for $6 like 90 days later. I mean,
wow,
crazy shit, like crazy, crazy shit. I remember IDT. I remember I was buying it for $2 at $10 of cash and $10 of NOLs and it was run rating $2 a share. And I remember putting like 40 or 50% of my net worth in that thing. And 15 months later, it was up 15X. I was selling it for $30.
Wow.
So, again, lucky, good, whatever, it was everything. It was very lucky. Very lucky to like right place, right time, was managing a small enough amount of money that like, you could find these sort of opportunities. And, I basically graduated Columbia Business School. I was like, I don't know. Like, I don't know what I don't know, which is like when I talked to all my mentors, they were all just like, "Whatever you're missing, I can't teach you. You're going to have to learn." And, one of my mentors said, "You got to touch the stove and, burn your fingertips, but I can't teach you that." Hmm. And so I just basically said to myself, I'm like, "Look, I'm 25 years old. There's generational opportunities out there, even still, in January of 11, even though we were off the bottom, 2010, 9 was up, 10 was up. But I said, these prices are still good." And so I just, jumped off the cliff because, I didn't want to be a situation where I was 40 years old and sort of, had all the sort of the creature comforts of, I was an entrepreneur. I wanted to, if I knew that I wanted to do it, why am I sitting around and waiting to do it?
Yeah, I think a criticism that's levied at you, perhaps improperly, and I think you deserve the question to be asked, but it's like, how much help did you get from your family and your dad's connections and whatnot? For those that don't know, your dad is a senator.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'll be careful the way I answer this. I think there were a lot of people that were actually afraid to invest because they felt like, well, you know, if I have a relationship with Adam's dad, well, I certainly can't invest with Adam. You know, that will show that, you know, I'm trying to curry favor with him or this and that. So if anything, I think it probably hurt me. I think there were a lot of people that I had a personal relationship with that should have invested, but didn't. And, you know, that was sort of hurtful to me. But again, like, I don't cry for me, Argentina. Like, I don't need anyone to invest because, because I'm the son of my father. They should invest because I'm good at what I do and because I care, and I'll, you know, kill myself doing it. But yeah, I mean, we started with very little amount of money, and, you know, it's largely been organic. And, you know, look, obviously, you know, we shorted stocks in the beginning. We're not doing a ton of shorting these days. You know, we are volatile, but, you know, again, it's like all I can offer to my investors is sort of the alignment and the fact that, you know, I'm all in. And, you know, I think up until last year, we hadn't even taken a dollar out even to pay taxes. And, you know, I took out a tiny bit of money, I think at the end of 21, to basically, you know, pay taxes. And, you know, look, I'm all in. I mean, look, I could not be more aligned with my investors. I've got, you know, the preponderance of my net worth in this thing. And, you know, I want this to be my vehicle. And when I look at, you know, Berkshire Hathaway, you know, yeah, Warren Buffett did 20% of your annualized, but the secret to it was that he didn't pay tax, right? He owned the same shares. And I think what people realize is, you know, people sort of conform their businesses, you know, to sort of be commercial. And, you know, we've been up, you know, 100%, you know, we were down, I don't know, 45% last year. I mean, it, you know, for us, it's sort of like, you know, it's much more important for us to, you know, get the stocks right over time, as opposed to trying to sort of conform a tear sheet, you know, that may look good on a, you know, pre-tax basis, but not on an after-tax basis. And so, you know, really what we're looking for is investors that, you know, are much more comfortable. I mean, I think for the first 11 years in the strategies, we did 24 net before the drawdown. And, you know, if that 24 net is actually a 24 net, not like a private equity IRR, like a, you know, doubling your money every 3 years, you know, and you're doing that with almost no taxes, like, you don't need to do that very long. So, you know, a lot of the growth has been organic. You know, obviously we're a super significant investor in the fund. And, you know, my hope is that, you know, we will, you know, be the largest investor in the fund. We were, and then, you know, we've got a couple families, and we got one family that, you know, technically is bigger than us right now, but that's great. I mean, look, that's what we want. We want people to, you know, come in when, you know, we're down. And I think, you know, a lot of people say, you look like you get the investors that you deserve. And I think, you know, while we've grown slowly, you know, I think we've grown really methodically and sort of gotten investors that sort of behave the right way at the right time. And so, you know, look, you know, I started this at 26 years old because I knew that, you know, good things take time. And, you know, I think being long-term greedy, I think, is the right way to do it. And if you can, you know, be methodical and thoughtful and, you know, not take shortcuts, you know, I think you can build a business to last. And so, you know, I'm what I'd say is I'm proud of what we've accomplished. I think we've assembled an investor base and sort of thought partners that I think are supportive. And you know, I think the key is just to continue to find people that sort of have the right economic alignment in terms of being taxable, in terms of owning quality businesses, and understanding that even though if somebody's giving you a 20% return and, you know, it's 100% turnover, it's not really 20%.
Yeah. Did you ever go through the period of investing where you made the mistake of, like, you know, I don't know, buying crappy assets that you perceived to be cheap? Or did you get mentors as a young kid that kind of kept you away from that line of thinking? I get the sense that you're looking at quality assets that are growing with people that you trust now. I'm curious if that's a development that you had to learn yourself, or whether
I learned it the hard way.
Yeah.
Well, everyone said it, but, like, I'm stubborn, so I had to sort of learn it the hard way.
Yeah. What's something you're embarrassed that you bought at some point?
Oh, we had USA Truck. Now, but that was interesting because it was sort of a trucking company that was under earning. And I'm not embarrassed. In fact, I'm sort of proud. You know, it's sort of like, okay, I did it, you know, in 2013 when my fund was small. It's like, I didn't do it when I was big. Now, J.B. Hunt's, you know, Intermodal is an incredible business, but that's more asset light. But, yeah, you know, it was a pure play trucking business, and they had a truck brokerage asset. And the idea was, oh, well, you know, they'll grow the truck brokerage asset and it's worth more than the entire market cap. But, you know, very hard to sort of without technology, it's very hard to sort of build pure play truck brokerage. And, you know, again, it was just like, you know, it's like the core business was challenging. It was capital intensive, and it was sort of a sum of the parts thesis. And I think, you know, we were sort of remiss to understand, like, well, you know, this truck brokerage business is really just overflow capacity for our existing business, and it's not really a standalone business. Yeah. One example. Yeah. Done plenty. I was in Sears hometown that was franchise hardware.
SHOS,
yeah,
right?
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. I hit that one hard. I got
Dude,
it.
Dude, I was calling the franchisees, yeah, asking them what they thought.
I got it. I hit it at the rights offering. I got it in the rights offering. Like, I forget what we created the asset at, $20. I think I sold most of it in the 50s. And, you know, Eddie took a private at two, but, you know, that was an example of a business where, like, you know, the franchise model made sense, except for the fact that, like, you know, what were the unit economics for the franchisees? What are the cash and cash returns? And so, you know, am I embarrassed? I mean, you know, a lot of people like, oh, well, you know, one guy, I was with the meeting today. He's like, oh, well, you know, you own Carvana. He says, well, you know, how do you feel about that? He goes, oh, I made money. I'm like, but you made money by accident. I'm like, you know, Sears hometown, like, we bought it at a decent price, but, like, you know, we sort of made money by accident. Like, you know, the argument I would make is that, like, maybe the execution was worse than we thought it was going to be. But, you know, again, I sort of come back to it and I'm like, you know, you sort of underwrite a business model, you know, obviously the price is the price, but if the business model sort of fails, well, the price is sort of irrelevant. So, you know, we've done a lot of that. I mean, I've made plenty of mistakes. I think, you know, I'm sort of proud that, you know, we've been quick to sort of recognize our mistakes, you know, or at least most of them along the way, but we've had plenty of painful ones. And, you know, look, at the end of the day, you know, we are an amalgamation of sort of our experiences and our mistakes, and keep coming back to people. I'm like, look, I'm 38 years old. I'm still standing. I keep getting kicked in the head. And, you know, the hope is just not keep making the same mistakes over and over again and making different ones. But, you know, look, it's, you know, last year was, you know, probably, you know, we probably came in with probably too much exposure, but, you know, our security selection was by and large pretty decent, you know, some mistakes here and there, but nothing, no crimes against humanity, nothing where the business model has basically been disproven. Probably a little overweight duration and factor, but, you know, again, you know, in our mind, you know, look, the market oversold sort of, you know, interest rate sensitive assets. And, you know, I think in general, the business models themselves are intact. You know, so, you know, I think over time these businesses will grow and, you know, sort of valuations will mean revert. But I mean, look, you know, every single drawdown, you learn something new. You know, sometimes it's exposure, sometimes it's factor, you know, but yeah, I mean, you're just trying to not make the same mistakes over and over again. And when you realize you've sort of, you know, made a crime against humanity, i.e. a business model that will never work, you know, trying to realize it as quickly as you can.
Would you, I mean, as a takeaway from last year, do you think that if there was an error, it's not hedging out a factor or trying to figure out how to hedge out some of the duration risk when valuations were where they were? Or is it a lot easier to say in hindsight than it was to live through?
Easier to say in hindsight, obviously.
Yeah.
But I mean, look, obviously in hindsight, like, you'd say to yourself, okay, like, par went down a bunch, and, you know, you'd say, well, you know, par went down a bunch, and, you know, did you think that, like, things were going to go down as much as they were? And, you know, was there a scenario where, like, the stock went from 90 at the peak to 60 and you bought put options and you wasted money? Now, in hindsight, like, you'd say, well, if I bought 2% of puts and this and that and I gave it away, like, is it the end of the world? But yeah, of course, everything is much easier in hindsight. But yeah, I mean, look, it's probably, we bought a bunch of Playboy at $10. We sold a bunch of it at 40, you know, or 45 on the way to 60. And then we kept the remaining portion. It was like a 2 or 3% position. It was sort of a stub. And, you know, they got, you know, they had a big, you know, sort of consumer business that, you know, was, and we took out more money than the way we put in, you know, 2 or 3x, but it didn't matter. It's like, we had a 3% position that went down 80%, like, you know? So I would say some of the mistakes that we made were sort of, you know, marginal, like, relative to, like, sort of the way we roll with position sizing. Like, you know, if you have a 3% position, it goes down 80%, it freaking sucks. But, you know, again, it's sort of like a lot, you know, what's worse, having a 30 going down 80 or a 3, you know, especially when the thing, you know, already took all your capital out of it. So, you know, I'd say, you know, hedging factor, you know, if there was a sort of an efficient way to do it, you know, obviously in hindsight, it would have been better. But yeah, I mean, look, these are all things that you sort of learn along the way. And it wasn't like I didn't know about factor, you know, and then we talked about it. But I said, you know, like, you know, I sort of looked at it and I said to myself, you know, I like these things. I can't really find a great way to sort of hedge the factor that's cost efficient and will give us the torque. You know, we talked about it. It was like IGV, NASDAQ. I'm like, but the NASDAQ and IGV could go up. Like, I want something that, like, you know, really sort of isolates mid-cap software. And just, look, these are the things. These are the flesh wounds. These are the battle scars. You know, and maybe the answer is I should have shorted some against the box. And, you know, instead of just doing that, you know, maybe I should, you know, if I'd gotten overvalued or sort of, you know, I don't know. And you sort of said, I'm just going to, you know, short some against the box. And if the stock goes down, I'll take the hedge off and, you know, buy it back. And there's lots of things you could do in hindsight. But, you know, again, this is, you know, part of the game and sort of learning. And, you know, and a lot of people would even say, Adam, you know, I don't even want you thinking about this. But, you know, look, I think, you know, we have, you know, people that say, you know, if you were right on the asset, you know, then, you know, stop thinking about this, you know. But again, I think you always sort of want to, you know, me personally, I am a believer of sort of reading the tape and going back and watching the bad plays and trying to understand for them. And maybe you say to yourself, like, you know, in the future, I won't be able to recognize it. I won't be able to do anything about it, but at least have the option to sort of, you know, harvest the lesson and the learning and saying, okay, like, what could we have done differently? Could we have seen it? Could we have not have seen it? What would it have been that would have been allowed to see it? And, you know, in the case of par, it's like, it, you know, it was at 35 and went to 10 and then, you know, went from 35 to 90. And the question is, you know, did the business increase? You know, did they grow ARR, you know, 3X by that time? I mean, by the end of 21, they'd bought Punch and they'd done that accretively. But, you know, it was a hard one. But again, it's sort of like I keep coming back to it, which is that, like, if you're right on the business and you're right on the people, you know, then, you know, when things go down, it becomes buying opportunities. I'll tell you what the advantage of being hedged was, is that if you'd sort of had, you know, and this is what Bill Ackman figured out, is that if you have sort of CDS or sort of out of money, the puts, what it is a funding mechanism to add to the positions when they go down. It's a funding mechanism.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, that definitely is. I mean, that's what I was talking to those guys about today, right? That now you got to know when to take the position off and when to use it for funds. But yes, that's exactly right. Do you tend to, I mean, I know you're looking to compound in excess of, I think, certainly average. I don't know what I'm allowed to say on a podcast and what I'm not. But does that lead you to smaller in general?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, as a general rule, we sort of don't want to invest in companies that are smaller than our asset base, you know, just, you know, as it relates to, we don't want to go over 10% and this and that. But I mean, I'd say in general, I think our sweet spot is sort of 1 to 10 billion in assets. Like, we want companies that sort of have enough scale that, like, they sort of, the public company cost drag. I mean, we see this where, you know, the companies sort of, like, they're sort of subscale in the public markets and sort of, you know, it's very, very challenging for them to sort of, you know, get off the ground and hit escape velocity. So I would say that, like, the billion to 10 billion, I think, is, you know, or even billion to 5 billion. I mean, I think you want businesses that sort of have enough profitability, enough scale that they sort of can hit escape velocity. Because remember, if it costs you $20, $30 million to be a public company, you know, between Sarbanes-Oxley, but also the CRM, the ERP, the GNA, the this and that, you want to, when the company grows, you want to be able to, you know, not sort of have that, you know, growth be subsumed by, you know, sort of, you know, infrastructure costs. And so I also just think that, like, you know, there are so many companies that sort of are microcap forever. You know, they sort of bounce around between 50 and 70 of EBITDA, right? They buy something, it fails, the business, you know what I mean? And so I think, you know, there are scenarios where, like Rick, for example, we're in the middle of COVID, you know, it got down to such a low multiple, you know, we bought a bunch of it, you know, and, you know, would we, in our asset size today, you know, if Rick had blown up, you know, would we do it? Probably. I mean, we wouldn't have been able to buy as much, you know, on a percentage basis. But, you know, it's, you know, I think in general, like, we want to find companies that sort of can, you know, and that, and this, look, the stock market's a relay race, right? You know, that, you know, people have different risk profiles. So if you can buy something that's sort of scratch and dent inventory, right? You know, we call it the Porsche in the barn phenomenon. We want to find the Porsche in the barn that, you know, if they, you know, if you clean it up, you know, maybe you get a tire change or, you know, brakes, but we don't want to do engine rehauls. And if we can find one of these things where we can get it sort of detailed and sort of get it on the road and driving fast, like, that's what we're looking for. So, like, Rick, for example, like, if Rick was $100 million at the bottom or 150 and, you know, we can buy it, but we know that EBITDA can grow from 50 to 200, like, that's a business that we can grow with, right? And that's what I'm talking about when I talk about, like, we want to find, you know, we want to find sort of dislocated assets that sort of create, you know, great buying opportunities on the front end and that we can grow with. And I think that to me is sort of, yeah, by definition, you know, you can buy something small that shouldn't have been small. It's sort of my process, right? Like, if you buy
something. You're talking about valuation wise.
Yeah.
Yeah. Small market cap on a business that justifies a much higher one.
Correct. Right. Yeah. I mean, if I'm buying, if I think Rick is, you know, 70 of EBITDA and it's $100 million market cap, and you think, you know, that's a big spread. Now the question is, if it's 100 and it's worth 700 or whatever number you land on, but that 70 can grow to 300, right? Because if you think about the, Chris Meyer talks about this in 100 baggers, but it's, you know, what is the etymology of the return? Right. You have to get elemental with it. Like, how do you generate it? What are the different things? So Buffett values securities and says, okay, what's the free cash flow yield? What's the growth? Right. That's the return over time. Right. And then, if you get multiple expansion, you know, that obviously augments the IRR. Right. And so, you know, when you think about these things, you're trying, you know, if you're buying something at a, you know, 100% free cash flow yield, well, it shouldn't trade there, right? Even if it doesn't grow, it should be at 10%. So in that situation, you know, you're like, okay, like I'm going to get multiple expansion just because, you know, even in a steady state, it's not going to trade at 100% free cash flow yield. It's either going out of business or it's going to trade it at like a 10 or a 12 or whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think you're trying to figure out, like, you know, it's one thing to buy, like, you know, if you say, hey, Bank of America, buy Bank of America calls at, you know, 0.3 times book value and it's going to trade at one, like you're buying something that, you know, is fundamentally mispriced. But then the question is the reinvestment rate interesting, right? And
yes.
So what we're trying to find things is buying them dislocated or misunderstood or whatever you want to call it at a cheap valuation relative to sort of, you know, exit value. Now, if exit value is low growth, maybe a multiple is X. And if exit value is, the company has a long growth trajectory, maybe the multiple is Y because it should reflect the growth rate, right? So, you know, sometimes you can buy a security and say, well, you know, the free cash flow yield plus the growth is good. I mean, Rick today, even at 90 some odd dollars, we think the free cash flow yield is, you know, 10%. And we think that they can grow earnings organic and inorganic at, you know, 30-40%. So that's a total return of 40-50%, right? Now, on top of that, we think a business that can compound free cash flow at 40-50% shouldn't trade at 10 times earnings or 10 times free cash flow. So, you know, if they don't get any more multiple expansion, we still get a great return, but we still think they should have a higher multiple based on the way their reinvestment. So there is some sort of reflexivity to the whole thing, right?
And then how are you thinking about like updating your growth assumptions as time goes on? Is it each quarter you're reassessing? Are you comparing to like what your model says? I'm just curious how you think about that.
I don't think we do it on a quarterly basis. Like, I don't think I'm so focused to say, okay, you know, they didn't buy this company or they didn't do this quarter. I mean, look, we review things and we sort of, you know, we look at things far more than on a quarterly basis, but I don't look at a quarterly report and be like, oh, like they didn't do this quarter. Like, I'm sort of looking at it and saying, are they making progress? Like, is Rick's M&A strategy working? Do I think they're sort of lining up targets? Do I feel like they have an effective funnel mechanism to, you know, find targets? Do I feel like they built out the internal infrastructure to sort of, you know, generate enough leads and build it out? Do I feel like, you know, this Denver thing with the casinos makes sense? Like, how are they thinking about it? So again, it's sort of like, I sort of review this stuff far more than on a quarterly basis, but I don't look at the numbers and say, okay, you know, the investment has to change based on this quarter or next quarter. I'm sort of abstractly looking at it and saying, are they preparing for the next 5 years? Like right now, like when I look at Rick's, I'm like, okay, I bought it when it was distressed. It's not distressed anymore. Okay. It still trades at a healthy free cash flow yield. And I still think like, even if they don't do any more M&A, you know, and they just grow organically, you know, 6, 8, 9, 10% sales and free cash flow goes 10-15%. It's still like at a suitable return, but, you know, and that's why, you know, we're not losing sleep over it. But at the same time, like, you know, the delta between a 20 and a 25 and a 50, right, you know, pre-multiple expansion would be, you know, what are the things they can do organically, like the casino or franchising Bombshells, or what can they do inorganically, like, you know, accretive M&A, you know, to sort of augment that return and sort of understanding sort of the product roadmap around that, right? And so, you know, from our perspective, you know, whatever he did over the last few years, it's more about what, you know, what are the pieces in place that he's putting in for the next 5 years?
Yeah.
And we want to make sure that, like, you know, I'm always sort of, you know, thinking ahead, being like, okay, like, you know, Stan Druckenmiller talks about, you know, you don't need to, you're not preparing for what's happened, you're preparing for what's going to happen. And so, you know, we're sort of making sure that like our companies are sort of, you know, developing the next, you know, 3 and 5 year plan. And that's where we're spending our time.
Yeah. So, you know, before we came on, you were talking about the bench, right? So you're spending your time going out, meeting the people that are implementing the plans, assessing whether or not they're thinking correctly. Like that's where your time is spent. And then in the quarterly numbers or whatever, it's a byproduct of what's going on, but it's not. You're not concerned about whether or not they're hitting a certain cadence. Is that a fair summary of what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's right. Like I again, like business is a messy thing and it's done with humans, right? And there's human beings and you can tell very quickly whether people are locked in or not. And, you know, if the CEO says, hey, you know we need to do this over the next 5 years, but we're focusing on this integration right now, blah, 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 blah. But they understand that they understand that they need to be, you know, sort of developing the product roadmap. But business is messy. Shit, you know, stuff happens. Like you got to figure it out, you know? And so I think it really is, it's a qualitative sort of, you know, it's a qualitative assessment that like people are understanding, okay, like businesses go through different iterations, right? You know, API Group has, you know, has this specialty contracting business, which, you know, was a larger percentage of the business before. And now is a smaller percentage of the business. We think that that might be holding back their cost of capital. And so, you know, they've said publicly, you know, I think on conference calls and stuff that like, you know, that they wouldn't, you know, they said at the, I think they said at the analyst day, I can't remember, but you know, they've sort of, you know, said, you know, look, you know, we would consider monetizing it. Now, obviously, if it's a private equity firm, interest rates matter. And, you know, they've got to basically, you know, develop, carve out financials for it. You know, that takes some time. But, you know, there are different things that go into it. But like, again, it's sort of like, it's sort of qualitative. It's like, you know, if a CEO says, oh, no, we'd never sell that, then like, okay, but like you realize that like if the capital intensity as a percentage of sales is much higher than your core business, and the, you know, if this thing's trading at 10% free cash flow yield, but if it was a pure play fire company, it would trade at a 3, you would sell it because you could sell it and use that cash to buy back stock in sort of the company that trades at a big multiple. So, you know, again, it's sort of like, well, you know, we did activism for a long time, and I think, you know, not to say that we'll never do it again, but like, you know, I really don't think I want to get back into that business because you spend a lot of time on the front end, you know, with a lot of ego and a lot of arrogance. And, you know, it's, you know, I think finding executives and chair people and stuff where the people are financially aligned with you, but also just like willing to sort of talk about, you know, different options and, you know, sort of have the humility and flexibility in the approach. And what we found is that there are situations where you have these owner operators and they own over 50% of the company, and, you know, and it's easier for them to steal than it is to create value. I mean, look, we were in this company where, you know, the guy, you know, in front loaded a ton of expense, told everyone he was going to do X, Y, and Z, front loaded a lot of expense. You know, maybe I'm too sort of cynical or paranoid or, you know, conspiracy theorist, but, you know, he basically tanked the stock and gave himself a bunch of stock, you know, and sort of, you know, sort of did this thing where like, oh, you know, I took the stock up. I didn't want to use the stock as a currency to sort of buy other assets, even though he said he was going to do it. And, you know, used the equity to basically buy other businesses, take all that EBITDA to basically, you know, build out the infrastructure, enrich himself, then tank the stock and then give himself more stock and switch the board. So, you know, look, you know, it's very easy to sort of get involved in idol worship. You're like, oh, well, the nephew of the guy is doing, but meanwhile, you know, he did a lot of things that were, you know, to enrich himself. He told shareholders he was doing X and turns out he was probably doing Y. And, you know, you look at the amount of shares that he's, you know, if you look at the amount of equity he's, I mean, look, you know, he's eroded shareholder wealth.
Yeah.
Right. That he basically gave himself a bunch of stock and, you know, bought a bunch of businesses and used that profitability to, you know, build out his infrastructure and build out, you know, his comp base for his business. And, you know, look, numbers don't lie, people do, right? I mean, that's just the reality. So, you know, and it's not, you know, again, if you think about how he started it, he, you know, he bought control of this, you know, public shell, similar to what Brad Jacobs did. And, you know, he bought 50% of it in an SPV. He had investors who said, you know, we're buying into this holding company. The shares are held into a holding company. And we talked to investors. They said, yeah, we can't get our stock back ever. So basically, he wasn't charging them any fees, right? He wasn't charging them 2 and 20 or anything like that. He was just like, give me the money to buy this, you know, buy a control of this public entity, and you're never going to get your money back. And you have no votes. So you don't unwind the SPV until you feel like it. Now, you know, in this specific case, right, like, you know, he basically got 50% control. He made everybody who sold them their business for shares to give them basically a voting agreement for an indefinite period of time. And I think that was the reason why he didn't want to do an equity deal in stock when the shares were up, because he didn't want to lose control and he didn't have a dual class. So, you know, you have a control freak who says, look, I own 50% of this thing, you know, I don't, you know, yes, I could do it a creative transaction, but I run the risk that I lose control of the asset, you know, that somehow, you know, someone else, you know, I, you know, me and my group isn't 50%. And so, you know, if I issue shares to these companies that I'm selling to, or they're selling to me, I have their votes. And if I issue stock to a, you know, an investor group, well, they're not going to give me their votes. Right. So, you know, look, you know, I come back to it. It's like, it's much easier to be a control freak, right? You know, than it is to create value. And, you know, ultimately, like if you're accessing the capital markets and you're doing the right thing, people will vote with you. But it basically is, you know, sort of elemental in that, like, he didn't want to dilute himself, even though it would be super accretive to his value, right? Like in his mind, he's like, well, if you had issued stock to buy a chemicals distribution asset or something like that, you know, if he was trading at 40 times EBITDA and he could buy something at 8 and do it all stock, well, that you do that all day. That's a Henry Singleton. But he was so worried about giving this guy stock, you know, that he lost the vote, that he said, you know what, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to wait until the stock goes down and give myself a bunch of equity. And I come back to it, which is if you issued stock now he did a bunch of little transactions that were not that dilutive, but what he should have done is raised equity third party through a bank, right? Which is what Brad Jacobs did, which is what a lot of guys do. Look at API Group, right? Like when API went from 10 to 26, they did a preferred offering with Blackstone. David Blitzer joined the board and they raised common equity at $26 to go and fund Chubb. And they said, look, we're selling equity at, I don't know what multiple it is, you know, 12, 10, whatever the number was. And we're buying Chubb at 6x pro forma. And that's what we're doing. So you look at sort of the delta there. It's like, you know, Chubb, we think is like 450 or, you know, 450 or 500 of EBITDA pro forma. And, you know, we look at that business and we say, look, that basically doubled the size of API Group. And you sort of look at Martin Franklin and what API did. Martin Franklin looked at this and said, he doesn't have a dual class. There's no dual class at API Group. Like, you know, everyone has votes. You know, Viking owns a bunch of stock. Yes. But like, again, it's sort of like, you know, they look at it and they say, look, you know, Martin Franklin says we are our own activists. Right. Like, you know, it's like if we think that something makes sense, like we'll do it because we're owners and because, you know, we are in the business of creating value. And like API Group is going to be an amazing asset that I think will be a, you know, multi bagger like Jarden. But like he's also in the business of building other public companies, and like his reputation matters. And I think what you find in a lot of these guys is they're like, you know, this is my first and last stop. You know, he looks at this and says, oh, I got this business. I got this founder to sell this to me. I've got this opportunity. I'm never going to have an opportunity this good. And so they hang on to it so tight, you know, because they're like, you know, they look at it and they say to themselves, well, I don't deserve this. I'm not going to get another opportunity. And so they're overly focused on sort of maintaining control. And it's like, I look at it in business and I think so many people, you know, sort of are contained with this zero sum game phenomenon where they look at it and they say to myself, they're like, okay, like, you know, I look at stocks, I say to myself, if a security becomes overvalued, you know, there's an opportunity cost because I can go and invest capital in something else. Why? Because I'm a fisherman. I know how to fish. Doesn't mean I catch fish every single day, but I know how to fish. I keep catching fish. And so many of these CEOs, they look at this and, you know, I call it the Shawshank Redemption effect. You know, it's like, have you ever seen the movie where the guy, the old guy is in the prison? And I got a few one-liners. You know, it's like, I was writing an email to a board member the other day and I was talking about it. It's like, it reminds me like that movie Alive where, you know, the board doesn't want to go after the CEO, but they should kill him. And they're like, they don't want to eat him. They don't want to, you know, kill and eat him. But, you know, in the Shawshank Redemption one's a good one because I don't know if you remember, it's a wonderful movie. Stephen King is a genius, by the way. Like he, you know, he's really just a genius, like a literary genius. And, there's that movie, what's the name? Tim Robbins. So Tim Robbins is the banker and he, you know, does the escape and, you know, is friends with Morgan Freeman. And there's this older guy who, you know, went to jail and they finally let him out and he's working in the grocery store and he, you know, is working bagging groceries. He's 80 years old and, you know, he doesn't have any friends and he's lonely and like prison is his life. Like that was his final destination, right? He couldn't understand life outside of the prison. And I sort of joke about this, you know, politicians are like this, you know, most politicians, they get in the business, they're in the business of getting elected. And it's like, you know, when they're not in politics, they like don't have a reason to exist. They don't have a skill set. They don't know what to do. And I think there's a lot of CEOs that sort of look at this and they say to themselves, I'm so enraptured with my little sort of fiefdom that like, you know, they can't manage anything out of a paper bag, you know, because when his stock was trading at 40 times EBITDA and all of these platforms, he needed to buy a platform to get into this new industry. And you were going to have to pay 10, 12 or 15 times. Well, he wanted to pay 5x because that's his model. He pays 5x, half in cash, half in stock. And what he didn't realize is that like, you know, if he had gone into bought in a platform in boilers in this and that and the other, maybe he would have paid 15 times. But if he was issuing equity at 40 times and, you know, maybe some of the equity goes to the seller or maybe some of the equity, you know, this is what Brad Jacobs did. If you look at, go look at Brad Jacobs or Henry Singleton, a lot of these guys issued equity to sort of primary shares to third parties to sort of finance sort of the roll up. And he didn't do it. Why? Because it would loosen his grip on the company. He only wanted to sell stock at low multiples. Think about this. If you're buying things at 5x EBITDA and you're trading at 40, well, you're not issuing that much stock. It's half cash, half stock. And by the way, and they're voting with you. And he was able to offset that dilution for the little deals by just giving himself more equity. He wouldn't have been able to offset the dilution to his voting control on a big deal, right? If you're trading at $400 million and you got $10 million EBITDA, and you want to go and buy a business that's doing 10 or 15 of EBITDA, and you're going and you're paying 15 times, that's 225, you're giving a third of the company away.
Yeah.
But it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, we go off on a tangent, but I think it's just such an important thing. Like,
so what was he selling when he was doing this? Was he selling a multiple arbitrage story? Like, I'm buying things at 5, I'm trading at 40. Look at how accretive this is, or something like that?
He basically was like, we're buying these businesses at 5x. You know, he bought a couple. He did something very untoward in the beginning, by the way. He got control of the first asset, and then he was already public, and he found another asset, and he did a private placement to his own group instead of doing a rights offering. Mm. So instead of allowing everybody to sort of participate in the financing to do this thing, which is what would have been the right thing, he did a private placement to himself. Again, to basically maintain control and because it was a good valuation. So, you know, he bought that thing at an incredible, you know, he was trading at, you know, 8, 9, or 10, and he basically bought that at 5, and he was like, oh, I'm going to, you know, the pro forma is going to be, you know, 6 or something, because they bought a business 3x the size of theirs. So they basically bought a business with, you know, with cash, but that was funded with the, you see what I'm saying? And they were doing, and so, you know, again, it sort of starts, it's all elemental, right? And, you know, and that's it. And, you know, I had, you know, one of our investors said to us, you know, when they did this rights offering, you know, he said, why didn't they offer it to everyone else? And he saw it. He knew immediately, you know, and I sort of wrote it off at the time. I'm like, oh, well, they need certainty of foreclosure at cash. But, you know, and you could sort of justify it in your head. But when all said and done, like, you know, someone who is so cavalier with their investors, both their private investors and their SPV and the public investors, when, you know, he did a private placement to a second SPV to fund a really good acquisition, it sort of tells you how he's going to treat his investors. So he basically gave them no information. He basically, you know, they acquired a lot of revenue really quickly. He didn't really communicate what his investments were. He basically, you know, took all the, now he gave you the EBITDA for the M&A, what he was buying, but he didn't tell you, like, you know, what he was investing in, what he was doing. And so, you know, the stock ran up. He did more M&A, you know, I think he basically thought, he goes, well, you know, if I tell anyone anything, you know, I'm going to lose the mystery. It's like, you know, it's the strong silent type. It's like, if I don't tell anyone anything, you know, maybe they think that I'm up to something. And so he sort of did that for a while.
How long were you in this before you were like, all right, enough of this crap?
So it's a great question. I started buying it. I remember I was in, it was Rosh Hashanah of September 16. Hey, Rosh Hashanah. I remember looking at it and they'd just done the deal. And I think I bought it, you know, started buying it. It was hard to buy, like $7 or $8 initially. And we bought it all the way up, but that was September of 16. And I think we sold our last share, you know, early 20 before COVID. So 17, 18, 19, 3 years, three
and a half
years.
You dealt with a lot of crap.
Oh my goodness.
Why rather than just like get out of it and be done with it?
Because it wasn't apparent. Like, you couldn't see it immediately. Like, he we started buying it at $7, $8. It finished 2017 at like $40. So we like made 5x our money in effectively, you know, or whatever it was, like a year and a half or whatever it was. But what was happening is that, like, and he kept doing M&A, but, like, you know, and he kept saying, oh, well, we bought this EBITDA, but then, like, there's other costs, there's public company, this, that, and the other. And so, you know, EBITDA was growing. I mean, it, what happened is it basically went, EBITDA went from like sort of like 3 to like 10 and sort of stayed at 10. And I suspect what was happening is he was traveling around, paying bankers, paying lawyers, looking at lots of transactions, not doing any of them. And he just didn't want the transparency. You know, yeah, there's CRM, ERP, this and that. But like, if you're making good investments, then why not tell people how much they are? I think he was just wasting the money and, you know, basically using it as his private piggy bank. You know, was he flying around on private planes? I don't know. Who knows? You know, it's sort of hard to sort of justify. You know, we've tried to sort of reverse engineer all the different sort of money that was going in and out. And yes, we do understand it is expensive to be a public company, but it was sort of hard to sort of get our arms around. But yeah, I mean, look, it sort of was one of those situations where, you know, you sort of have a built-in gain. You know, so you're like, okay, like, do I want to sell it? Do I want to pay the taxes? You know, they have this currency, you know, they're telling you, and it was also sort of like, they were saying, oh, we're looking for big deals. We're doing this, we're doing that. And it wasn't like, I couldn't, you know, it was sort of like taking management at face value. And you have to do that next layer, which is, are they shining you on? Yeah. Are they saying one thing and doing another? And that was what this is sort of was a lesson in.
Well, I suspect that'll be a lesson that you'll take for a long time.
Yeah, we spent about 30. I don't know how much longer we're talking about it, but you know, it's like I talk about mistakes and lessons, and it's like, you know, I think the biggest, you know, risk in this business is you can develop A, investing with sociopaths, and B, becoming one. And if you are not willing to talk about the mistakes that you've made and the things that you've learned, then you know, then you're not growing. You're not growing as an individual. You're a sociopath, right? Like if you can't actually look people in the eye and be like, I messed this up. This is what I didn't see. And, you know, lots of people, they can say, well, you know, it's hard to see at the time. I'm like, okay, yes, it might have been, and it was. But if you're not doing, if you're not running the tape back and you're not looking at this stuff in hindsight and being like, and saying, okay, like, is he telling me this? You know, is it, you know, it's like, you know, if he's telling me we're looking at this and the Rick guy's like, oh, we're doing all this stuff. It's like, okay, like, you know, Rick is saying, you know, he's doing this stuff. Now the valuation is better and there's a lot less downside risk, but you know, it's sort of, you know, if I look at the transparency that Eric is providing relative to like the guy, you know, it's like night and day. And it's sort of like, if you're transparent today and you're always transparent, then I just think it's an amalgamation of sort of cues, right? It's like, you know, the level of transparency, the fact that they're, you know, they're telling you, you know, they're working on these things, but they're not telling the public markets, you know, like it's like if a guy says, hey, you know, says at the shareholder meeting, we're working on M&A and we're working on finding big things. And, you know, they're just, you know, telling people, you know, what they want to hear, but like they're not putting it in writing and they're not giving you the disclosure around where the income statement investments are. It's sort of like, I just think transparency is it. You either do it or you don't do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes there's a reason, you know, well, you know, sometimes there's a business reason why you wouldn't be saying something. So like, my point is I don't know what my ultimate cost basis was, whether it was 10 or 12 or whatever it was. But like, my point is that like, you know, it was like the average, whether it was the guy who was selling him his business or whether it was, you know, shareholders who acquired it. Like, I suspect like over the last 7 years, the preponderance of the investors haven't made any money and he doesn't care because he just, keeps saying, oh, I'm long-term this and that. And I'm like, yeah, look, I get it. Long-term is long-term. And, you know, I look in any given period of time, like, you know, this has been a tough 5 years for us too. Now we ended, you know, but at the same time, like what's the level of transparency and what are you trying to, you know, what are you trying to, you know, do you feel like you have a duty to perform? And, you know, if you said to them, hey, you know, this thing's going to stay at $20 for the next 5 years, you'd be like, okay, whatever. But like, you know, that's because he, you know, he looks at it and says to himself, you know, I'm building wealth. I keep giving myself shares. I keep, you know, and so, you know, his side of the ledger is improving. If, you know, my side of the ledger doesn't improve if I don't make money. I've got a huge personal investment in this fund. Like, you know, it's not like the management fees are substantiating anything. And it's not like I'm giving myself free stock. You guys are giving themselves free stock.
Yeah. So how, I'm curious how you, like, I'm just juxtaposing this to my perception of API Group. And I'd be curious how you found API. And if you just talk about that a little bit and then we can wrap up.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, API Group was interesting. We had an investment in this company, Diamond Resorts, which was a timeshare company that sort of was a broken IPO. You know, there was a lot of really smart people involved. They sort of built the company. It was a company that was sort of this company called Sunterra, actually, that, you know, Josh Friedman from Canyon Partners built before he started Canyon. And it was a nice timeshare management business. They'd had some sort of accounting misstatement or something, and they were getting delisted, and it was a nice business, 100 of EBITDA. sort of felt like it was a good business, but sort of, you know, poorly sort of poor governance. It wasn't like there wasn't fraud or anything like that. It was just like bad controls. And this guy knew someone in the industry, this guy Klubeck, and they put together money from Guggenheim and Soros. They took it private with, you know, with 100 of EBITDA, with, you know, basically they vended it in a timeshare agreement, and it ended up getting sold to Apollo for like $3 billion of equity or something. I think that's right. $3 billion. I can't remember. It's either $2 billion or $3 billion. I think it was $3 billion, but I can't remember. But it was a bootstrap transaction, like an original LBO, right? It was all leverage and preferred, and then they delevered. So, you know, coming out of it, there was no, you know, meaning, you know, a lot less debt and 500 of EBITDA. So you can see about, you know, think about the LBO math, you know, at 6 times. I think it was $3 billion, because I think it was like 6 times 500. That's number is just sticking with me for a minute. I think it was like $3 billion, which is meaningful equity creation, right? If you're in for zero equity, yes, effectively.
Not bad.
So $3 billion of equity.
Yeah.
To split up among partners and public market shareholders. But, you know, one of our now an investor of ours, you know, said, hey, you know, my, in Yiddish, machatunum, but, you know, my daughter married, you know, this guy's son, and, you know, they're doing this fire safety and inspection roll up. And I sort of knew, you know, it's a nice segue. I knew all the different sort of high quality business. Cause remember when I dumped, I like elevator maintenance, fire sprinkler, like garage door. Like I looked at all the different sort of, you know, horizontal verticals that they could get into to leverage their corporate infrastructure. And fire safety was one that we thought was super interesting. Elevator maintenance, fire, HVAC. These are all great businesses. HVAC was a great one. You know, Wasco did HVAC distribution, but they didn't do HVAC service. There was a huge business called Service Logic that I was like, why aren't you buying this? You know, it's whatever. But, you know, I perseverate so much. It's like you get me on a negative thing and I can't get off it. But, you know, it's a nice segue because it's sort of like good governance, bad governance, or bad governance, good governance. But like I sort of knew all these sort of, you know, sort of what I call these really high quality industrial distribution service assets. I sort of studied the crap out of them. And so like, I was so prepared for it. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, you're prepared for the test. It's like, we knew about fire safety.
Yeah.
We loved the business. So here it is. Here's this holding company that, you know, there was a guy who was a chairman. Basically, this guy's father started the business. He was an absentee sort of executive chairman. The current CEO, Russ Becker, grew up from like $600 million to $4 billion in sales. They had a Danaher-style culture. You went there and you're like, you know, again, talk about like six people that could run it. It's like you go out to Minnesota and it's like, you know, it's like Nike, or I can't even explain it. It's like you have cross-functional leadership. You have guys who've been in different parts of the business. I mean, it's like a Swiss Army knife. It's like no business I've ever seen before.
That's neat.
It's really, really cool. They have like a learning center. They have like, you know, the controller wasn't met up for CFO, so he ended up being running a business unit. But it's just like, I've never seen anything like this. You know, Fiat actually tried to have it. You know, Sergio sort of had the cross-functional leadership, but it's just this idea that you can work in different parts of the company and learn different parts, and, you know, sort of creates sort of longevity of personnel and experience, and super interesting. You know, this guy, Paul Grunau, had an HVAC family business. He came in, he ran one division, then he became the chief learning officer. But like, it's just, you know, you could sort of tell that they were really fostering, you know, leadership development. You know, they I remember with the CEO, he said, oh, management. He goes, no, we don't have management. We have leaders, you know? And so their log line is building great leaders. And when you go into the headquarters, you can see it. So, you know, I basically looked at this thing and I'm like, okay, like they, you know, this business, you know, 35% of it was owned by an ESOP. They had a deal with Carlyle. They were basically going to sell the fire business, we think, to Blackstone at like a huge multiple, and then just do, you know, lever recap, you know, do a dividend recap on Shitco. And we basically figured out that, like, you know, now the CEO or the chairman wanted that as their legacy. So, you know, enter Martin Franklin and API Group. They basically offered cash. You know,
he SPAC'd it, right?
Yeah, but it was a UK-based SPAC, so they basically SPAC'd it. But different, you know, the way it works is the capital is permanent. Like, so you don't have, when you raise a UK-based SPAC, I mean, Martin put like $200 million in, so like, let's start with that. And then all the investors, Viking, I mean, basically still owns the stock. They own 20% of the company or whatever. So like, you know, this was basically a platform investment, not like a SPAC.
Yeah.
And they don't get any free shares day one, the way a regular SPAC is. They only make money if the company does well. So like the promote, so to speak, sort of gets earned out.
It's like an earnout. Yeah.
It's like an earnout. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, they don't get it on
it's
the whole
better incentive system.
Oh, much better.
Yeah.
Well, and if you think about the business since we invested, I mean, there was, I don't know, 375 of EBITDA, you know, I think Martin was, you know, has a history of building businesses, whether it was Benson Eye Care with Warren Kanders, which happened very quickly when he was very young. And then Jardin, which was sort of his big one. I mean, not that Benson Eye Care, I mean, I think he did amazing, but it was just off of a smaller base. And then, you know, I forget what the market cap of Jardin was when they sold it, 12 or 15 billion or something from nothing. But, you know, Martin, you know, had a history, you know, Martin and Jim and Ian and the whole gang, you know, he sort of, you know, sort of built his SWAT team, and now he's got his kids in there. And, you know, he sort of built this sort of, you know, this Mariposa Capital, which, you know, after Jardin, you know, he sort of built out these other businesses. And so, you know, Cute Burger King, which he did with Bill Ackman, that did okay. He did a couple other SPACs and before the financial crisis, but, you know, not on a big scale. They were US-based SPACs. You know, he hadn't, you know, monetized Jardin yet. So I don't think he was in a position to write $200 million checks. Once he sold Jardin, you know, had real capital and sort of couldn't, you know, write checks into this stuff. But, you know, we sort of looked at it and said, you know, Burger King was great. Jardin was great. And Benson Eye Care was phenomenal. And we sort of looked at this and said, hey, here's a guy who is an absolute stud and a winner. He made one footfall, which was this platform acquisition, this chemicals business. And they own it. They say, look, we bought a commodity cyclicals business. We didn't buy an in-place management team. We should, you know, probably should have kept the management team at McDermott instead of changing things up. And, you know, look, that was their worst deal and it's going to be profitable. I don't know what the IRR will be. I mean, it's now Element Solutions and, you know, they divested all the garbage and, you know, it's a super high quality business. And so I looked at it and I said to myself, okay, like you've got a guy with an amazing track record. He made one bad deal. I mean, look, even Nomad is fine. But like, you know, you look at Jardin and you look at Benson, they were Adam Wyden style returns. And I said, look, here's a great business, fire safety with an in-place management team and good capital allocation. Like, can API Group create an Adam Wyden return? And the short answer is yes. I mean, you know, you think about it, like, I think we started buying it at like $9 or $10. I think the stock's 21, you know, and that's, you know, over what we started. I mean, that's basically over 3 years, right before COVID. So 20, 21, 22. And, you know, you had a huge pandemic, you know, a lot of stuff, but even more importantly, like they basically sold all the crap and they bought Chubb. And, you know, when we bought it, I think it was 375, sort of like 50% fire. And now we think it's $1 billion of EBITDA and like 80% fire. So think about the mix,
yeah,
right? So, you know, it's not that the specialty business is a bad business. It's just lower multiple. But I mean, Leonard Green owned an asset called Pi Barker, where they sold half of it to Altus Partners in Toronto. I think Altus paid 23 times EBITDA. We think that API Group is trading at like 7 times. You know, we think they'll do $1 billion or nearly $1 billion of EBITDA in 24. And, you know, on that number, you know, we think we're paying like 7-ish times. So why would you pay 23 times for a business doing 100 or 130 of EBITDA when you could pay 7 times for one that's doing $1 billion with a best-in-class management team?
Yeah.
So, you know,
it makes sense to me.
Yeah. This to us is just like, you know, now, you know, do they, you know, are they going to grow organically? Like we think the fire business will grow organically, you know, 7-9% sales. And we think that should manifest itself in 15-20% earnings growth as they're leveraging their structure. Right. Because remember, if your contribution margin, you know, like they've guided to like 13% EBITDA margins in 25, you know, I think it'll be higher than that. Like, you know, we look at little decks of little fire safety, you know, companies, you know, plenty of them have locations at 30% margins. So, you know, obviously more service, but as they get more service and they get sort of in more of the higher margin, you know, business, you know, do I think that, you know, the fleet average store can do 18-20%? And if, you know, if corporate is, call it 50 basis points of sales or something, can you, you know, sort of get to high teens EBITDA margins on a consolidated basis? Yes. And, you know, our point is that without the cyclicality and sort of the statutory nature of this business, you know, we think that this business could trade at a, you know, look at First Service, look at Rollins, look at Terminix, look at Cintas. These are 2% and 3% free cash flow businesses, right? So, you know, you work backwards on the math, right? If it's a 5%, you know, 20 times EBITDA, it's 5% pre-tax and after tax, it's 4, you know, this is a 20 times EBITDA business, right? Realistically, if you have a 4%, if this thing trades at a 4% free cash flow yield and it can grow earnings, you know, sort of 15-20%, you know, even 10-15%, you know, that pencils out for sort of a closet index hugger at 20%. And my view is, you know, if I can basically etch out an exit multiple where, you know, this sort of the closet index hugger, the guy at the big mutual fund can sort of pencil out a 15-20% return, and I can, you know, make a huge return along the way to get to that point, then we're money in the bank.
Yeah.
You know, so
interesting.
You know, it's a fun game, man. It's super humbling, man. It's have been really kicked in the head a few times. But I'll tell you that, you know, it is rewarding to talk about, you know, to say, you know, look, at this point in time, you know, we've got some good assets. You know, we've got PAR, we've got RIC, we've got APG, we've got GFL. I mean, we've got some really great owner operator assets that are, you know, sort of fundamentally mispriced, or where we feel like, you know, the path to value convergence is there. And, you know, we're not, you know, sitting here wringing our hands worried that these guys are going to steal from us. And, you know, look, it's, you know, Berkshire has had their share of drawdowns and we have too. And, you know, I think it's nice. And I'll tell you this time around, you know, I think what's nice about it is that, you know, we do have the comfort of owning assets that are compounding in value, you know, where, you know, we know that over time, you know, that we're going to get paid. I think that that's a good feeling. You know, it's like, I've been through it, like in 18 and 19, like I had to get out of EVI, like I couldn't do it. Right. So we spent.
Yeah. This time you're comfortable in the assets.
I spent a lot of time. Well, I mean, it's like, you know.
And with the people that you own it with.
Correct. And so like coming into COVID, we had cash, and some of that was we were worried about the market. But some of it was also just like we had assets that, like, we sold Ferrari in the summer of 2019. We sold EVI because we weren't getting through to the guy, you know, not in our best interest. And so, you know, I think, you know, we sort of like had to. You know, we had API at the end of 19. I'm trying to think, you know, we had RIC in the beginning of 20, but like, you know, we had to sort of clean the decks and sort of, you know, really recognize what we want and what we don't want out of life. And I think, you know, I do think that, you know, this feels very different now because it's like, as you said, like we have people that we want to be in business with businesses that we like.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good place to be. You don't mince a lot of words, Adam. Right, you tell people what you think.
Yeah,
I think on social media it gets you in some fights, but I'm not sure that those fights. I think if people met you face to face, they might think differently.
Well, I just think, you know, look, I'm probably the biggest critic of myself. You know, I've made so many mistakes. I've done a lot of things that I wish I hadn't. And, you know, I you know, both, you know, in from an investment perspective and the rest. And I'm a humanist. I want to be better. I want everyone to be better. I really do like people. I really like gravitate to people and, you know, people and energy, but I don't like phony people. And I really don't. And I think, you know, there are so many people that live this sort of automaton life where they go into their office and they sit there and they're like, okay, like, let me look at this tear sheet. Let me read, you know, this, that, and the other. And they're sort of looking for someone to conform into a certain thing. And it's sort of like, you know, whether it's a guy at a pension fund or an endowment saying, hey, you know, Adam charges too many fees, or, you know, oh, you know, he's too volatile, or this and that. And it's sort of like, you know, get on the freaking field and figure out how hard it is to do this. And like staying up till 5 o'clock in the morning and doing this stuff. And what we're finding is that, like, you know, when you're in business with CEOs that like are, you know, living and dying with it, like, you know, there is a fundamental language that sort of is spoken and understood. And I think, you know, I just think for me, it's sort of like so many people, they, you know, whether it's on Twitter or hiding behind some sort of anonymous thing and like punting, you know, writing mean stuff about people. And I just think it's, you know, look, lots of people got crushed last year. And, you know, look, you know, myself included, and, you know, no one is infallible. But I think, you know, I think that so many people sort of have this Schadenfreude part of this, like where it's like, you know, oh, this guy and that guy and this and that, and this guy's dad is this, and this is why it failed. And I'm like, no, like, it's just like, we're all humans. We all put our pants on one leg at a time, and, you know, we all make mistakes. And I just, I don't like this counterculture of just like, you know, and I don't know if it's TikTok or Instagram, I don't know, Twitter, but it's just this idea that like we're looking at people's lives, and it's just so easy to like look in through the window and say, oh, you know, this person is doing this or that. And I just think so many people, like, they don't actually get on the field and lace up the sneakers or the cleats and figure out what it takes. And I have so much appreciation for these little guys starting these businesses. And I've tried to make myself available, you know, whether it's through Scott Miller and his Greenhaven Fund Partners funds and his field team of small investors, or people that reach out to me on Twitter. And, you know, there are plenty of people that reach out, and I just try and make myself available because, you know, again, I really do think that, you know, you never know where the next great investment idea comes from. You know, if some kid who's 16 years old has the next Monster beverage, like, I want to know about it. And, yeah. You know, I just think, like, the end of the day, the best thing we can do is sort of be honest with ourselves and with everyone else and, you know, show that we have the financial alignment, show that we do care, you know, and that there's integrity, and, you know, that I'm financially aligned with my partners, and then I will, you know, break my back, you know, for forever, because, you know, I don't want to do anything else. I want to do this, and I want to win at this. And if I can't win at this, I'll give the money back. And, you know,
what drives you at this point?
I think, you know, it's interesting. I love the game. I was actually with Joel's partner, and he said, he goes, look, I remember investing in this company. It was a demutualization of a Citibank. And he's like, I put like whatever I put 30, 40, 50% of my net worth in it. And he's like, I knew that I was going to like whatever, double, triple, quintuple my money. And he's like, it wasn't like when it actually happened, it wasn't even that, you know, exciting because I knew it was going to happen. It was the thrill of spotting the kill. And I sort of relate to that. It's sort of like, it's like the thrill of like the next score. It's the satisfaction of being right and the motivation of being wrong. You know, it's sort of like, you know, I do think that I can add value to companies. And I think like in an intangible way, like if I can get involved in a company and make it better, I think that's satisfying, right? If I can, you know, make the return even better, whether it's through talking about capital allocation or, you know, business idea, but ultimately like these CEOs are great and like, they don't need my advice. If I can help on the margin, I will, and I'm happy. But, you know, I think it's just, it's the game. I mean, I think it's incredibly challenging and thought provoking and motivating. And I want to, you know, develop a best in class track record, and like not at the expense of turning over my portfolio 100% a year. And I suspect, you know, Warren Buffett said he could do 50. I'm sure I could do better if my turnover was higher. Like I know I could, but would that create better after tax wealth for both myself and my partners? Probably not. Right. If I was doing 40 net, but it was 100% turnover, like I'm not sure that creates a better result than where we were over 11 years, pre-tax, after tax.
Yeah. Yeah, the tax drag is a real thing and sucks.
Yeah, and the institutions don't care about it because they don't pay it.
Yeah. All right, one more and then I'll let you get out of here.
Yeah, that's what's all good.
What does being Jewish mean to you?
It's a great question. You know, look, my son goes to Jewish day school. You know, look, for me, you know, it's an identity thing, right? It's like, it's, you know, I don't keep kosher, but I don't even know if I believe in God. I haven't really made up my mind on this, but what I can tell you is that like the traditions, you know, the concept of tikkun olam and giving back. I mean, I think, you know, it's sort of like it's a way of living your life, right? Like living a righteous life. And I don't want to sound arrogant and saying, oh, well, Jewish people are the only righteous people. I mean, there are plenty of, Bernie Madoff was a Jewish guy. He was certainly not righteous. But like, my point is that like a lot of the lessons and teachings I think are, you know, family oriented, you know, tikkun olam, giving back to the community, making the world a better place. And, you know, look, I've been, you know, very fortunate. You know, look, you know, I was, you know, member of ZBT, a Jewish fraternity at Penn, but they had non-Jewish people, but, you know, unbelievable. And not to say, oh, you know, being Jewish is a great network and whatnot, but I just think like, you know, it's the traditions, it's the family values, it's the, you know, and you know, I'll be careful the way I say this, but, you know, look, you know, Jewish people have been run out of countries and places for millennia. And, you know, I hope that doesn't happen anymore. I think the United States is this is a little bit macro, but, you know, I think the world is a much safer place than it's ever been. And I'm sort of optimistic. Someone said, well, how do you think about the macro? I'm like, you know, it's interesting. You know, I think if you look at the coordination around COVID and sort of interest rates and stuff, you know, and also just like what's happening with the Middle East and the Abraham Accords, I mean, there is more coordination and more sort of, you know, community. I mean, look at China. Like everyone thought China would come to Putin's back and they didn't. So, you know, I would say that like, I am like cautiously optimistic that like, you know, people are sort of now, I don't like, there are people, I feel like in a lot of ways, yes, there's class warfare, there's issues with money and this and that, but I think in general, globally, I think people are looking after one another a lot more than they used to. And that gives me hope. And, you know, I think, you know, because, you know, Jewish people have, you know, sort of, you know, faced, you know, and look, I don't want to measure it relative to African Americans or anyone else. I mean, there are plenty of people that have been, you know, prejudiced and whatnot. What's going on in this country is terrible with the police and this and that. But I think in general, you know, Jewish people have experienced some prejudice along the way and have been run out of town. And I think, you know, do understand sort of the plight of humanity. And you know, we've had many, you know, there are many great things that you know, business opportunities, this and that, like, you know, I've been afforded, you know, many great opportunities. I'm sure some of them because I was Jewish or whatever, you know, went to this school or that thing. But, you know, look, I think at the end of the day, you know, we are a byproduct of our experiences and, you know, our energy and our passion and our ability to work hard. And, you know, I just think that, you know, many of the things that I've sort of learn from my parents and my grandparents and sort of, and my wife and her family and this and that. It's that, you know, these are important traditions. And, you know, I'm not to say that I wouldn't get it from another sort of sociocultural sect, but I think it's been really rewarding for me in terms of, you know, this access to community and sort of understanding what's important in life.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, I think my wife would probably say a lot of the same things about Catholicism, right? And I grew up in a Jewish household, and I think that there are a lot of similarities. And I just know anyone that's talked to you, it comes up a decent amount in a conversation. So I wanted to ask you. So with that, you know, I just want to say thanks for joining the pod, man. And, you know, we can do it another time or not. And let's hang out for a bit. And thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
But it's absolutely necessary.